All right, welcome to the deep dive. Today, we're going way back to 1977.
Oh, wow, back in the day.
Yeah, to a case that's, well, it's a real cornerstone in how we approach securities fraud cases even now.
I see, a classic.
Exactly. Stern v. American Bankshares Corp. from the Eastern District of Wisconsin.
Okay, Stern. I'm familiar with it, but a refresher is always good.
Yeah, for all of you out there wrestling with securities law, trust me, this one's packed with lessons you'll use throughout your careers. It's fundamental.
What makes this case stand out, even after all these years? Why is it so foundational?
Well, it really lays out some big, really important principles about what a plaintiff actually needs to say when they're going to court with a fraud claim, specifically in securities law. It's not just, you know, something bad happened. It's about how you frame that bad thing in the legal sense, how you articulate it for the court.
The nuts and bolts of pleading. That makes sense. I mean, getting that right is often make or break in these cases.
100%. So our mission today is to unpack Stern, like really get into the nitty-gritty. We're going to pull out those lasting insights about pleading standard, especially Rule 9b. You know, that's the one everyone stresses about in fraud cases.
Right, Rule 9b.
And we'll look at control person liability, aiding and abetting, the whole nine yards.
Sounds like a good roadmap. What kind of materials are we working with today to dissect this case?
Oh, we've got the works. A full case brief, a pretty deep perplexity analysis. Those always get into the weeds of the court's logic.
Yeah, those are interesting.
And even one of those standard briefs laying out the whole legal framework of the decision, you know, the rule of law, the facts, all of that.
Okay, great. So to kick things off, why don't we rewind back to 1977 and set the scene? What was the genesis of this whole legal battle? What prompted Daniel Stern to file this lawsuit?
Sure. So it all started with Daniel Stern buying securities from American Bankshares Corporation. The heart of his case was that before he made that investment, he was basically given a distorted view of the company's financial health, particularly with American Bankshares and its subsidiary, which was American Citibank.
Okay. So his claim was that he was misled, basically.
Yeah. That he was led to believe things were better than they actually were, both through things they said, but also through things they didn't disclose, which is crucial in securities law. You have an obligation to tell the whole story.
Were these just sort of general accusations, or did Stern actually point to specific instances of misleading information or omissions?
I don't know. This wasn't vague at all.
Yeah.
The complaint was really specific. He pinpointed four separate times where he claims there were false communications. And those communications, he argued, really overstated how financially stable American Citibank really was. You know, like painting a rosy picture, way rosier than reality.
And what sorts of communications are we talking about here? What were those four specific instances he alleged?
Well, things like financial disclosures that were, he claims, straight up misrepresented, making the bank look a lot healthier than it was.
Okay, so some really specific allegations about the content of those communications. Now, I'm curious, who exactly was Stern suing? Was it just the corporations themselves, or were there other parties involved in the lawsuit?
Well, he went after both the companies involved, American Bankshares and American Citibank. But it's interesting, he also named the FDIC as a defendant, which is kind of unusual.
The FDIC, that's the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, right? What were they doing in this lawsuit?
Right, the FDIC. In this case, they were acting as the receiver for American Citibank. Because remember, the bank ended up failing. And on top of that, he also named a bunch of individual executives from the company as defendants, too. So he cast a wide net, legally speaking.
Interesting. So he went after the corporations, the government agency involved in the bank's failure, and even individual executives. It sounds like a pretty comprehensive approach. Now, before we dive deeper, let's make a step back and look at the legal foundation of the case. What were the specific federal and state securities laws that Stern alleged were violated by all these misleading communications?
Great question, and it's key to understanding how everything plays out. On the federal side, he was relying on some of the biggest guns in securities law, Section 10B, and importantly, Rule 10B5 of the Securities Exchange Act of 1934.
Ah, the classic anti-fraud provisions.
Yeah, the very foundation of fighting fraud in the securities world. He also brought in a claim under Section 77E of the Securities Act of 1933. That one's all about making sure securities are properly registered, which can be a big deal when things go wrong.
Okay, so hitting them with both the 33 and 34 acts. Makes sense.
Exactly. And to be thorough, he also threw in claims under Wisconsin State Securities Law, since that's where all this was happening.
Okay, so a multi-pronged attack using both federal and state securities law. A classic approach. Now, let's get into the real meat of this case, something that's going to come up constantly for any law student tackling securities fraud. Rule 9b of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. The court ultimately upheld the main fraud claims against the corporations themselves. But what was it about Stern's pleading that convinced the court he'd met this really demanding standard?
Yeah, this is where it gets really practical. It's not just about having a good case in theory. You need to know how to translate that into a winning argument in court.
Yeah.
So the court agreed that the main fraud claims against American Bank Shares and American Citibank, those were good to go. But it's all about Rule 9b, right? This rule basically says, look, you can't just waltz into court and yell fraud. You can't just be vague. You got to get specific.
Right. You can't just say, they lied to me. You need more than that.
Way more. The rule says you have to state the circumstances constituting fraud. And you have to do it with particularity. You have to lay it out in detail. It's not just, hey, they misled me. It's this specific person said this specific thing on this date, and here's why it was false or misleading. You have to connect all the dots for the court.
And how did Stern's complaint hold up under that microscope? What kind of details did he provide that convinced the court his claims had merit, at least at this initial stage?
Well, the court liked that his complaint was very detailed in identifying these specific false statements, the exact things that were said. And crucially, it wasn't just someone made a misrepresentation. He actually named names, saying who specifically made those misleading statements, particularly about American Citibank's finances. That level of detail was really important.
So it was all about painting a clear picture for the court, not just making accusations, but backing them up with who, what, when, and where.
That's it. And remember, this was just the pleading stage. The court wasn't saying he had to prove everything beyond a reasonable doubt right then and there. It was more like, okay, you've shown us enough that this isn't just some frivolous claim. Let's move forward and see where the evidence takes us.
A crucial distinction. Now, Rule 9b gets even trickier when we consider the concept of scienter. That's the defendant's state of mind, their intent to deceive. How did the court handle that requirement, especially with this high bar for specificity?
Yeah, good point. Scienter is huge. You can't just say someone made a false statement. You also need to show that they knew it was false or were reckless about the truth. In Stern, the court said that at this early stage, just alleging that someone acted with reckless disregard for the truth, that was good enough to satisfy the scienter requirement under Rule 9b. They weren't demanding proof of intent to deceive right out of the gate.
So alleging reckless disregard gets your foot in the door, so to speak, but you'll need to prove it later on in the case.
Right. And they even brought up past decisions from the Seventh Circuit, which is where this case was, to back that up. So alleging facts that point to recklessness can get you through the initial hurdle. You don't have to come out swinging with direct evidence of intentional malice.
That's a really important nuance to remember. Now, we know that while the primary fraud claims against the companies survived, the court dismissed the aiding and abetting claims against some of the other defendants. Why was that? What went wrong there?
Okay, so here's where things get even more complex.
Yeah,
those aiding and abetting claims, those got tossed out. And the main reason, you guess it, Rule 9b strikes again. The court said, look, your complaint doesn't give us enough specifics about how these other defendants actually helped with the fraud. It wasn't specific enough to really link those secondary players to the main event, the primary fraudulent actions. It was like they were missing a key piece of the puzzle.
So even though those other defendants might have been involved in some way, Stern just didn't plead their involvement with enough detail to satisfy the court.
Exactly. Rule 9b is a stickler for details. You have to paint that very clear picture of not just what happened, but who did what to make it happen. You have to connect those dots with precise allegations.
Makes sense. Now, let's shift gears a bit and focus on the individual executives who were named as defendants in the case. How did the concept of control person liability factor into their involvement in the lawsuit?
Okay, so this brings in two key parts of securities law, Section 20A of the Exchange Act and Section 15 of the Securities Act. Basically, what they say is, if you're someone who controls another person or a company that breaks securities laws, you can be held liable for that too.
So it's not just the company itself that can be on the hook. Individuals in positions of power can be held responsible as well.
Exactly. In Stern, the argument was that these executives, they were calling the shots at American Bank Shares and American Citibank. And because of that, they should share the blame for the alleged fraud that went down.
So what exactly does it take to establish that control element under securities law? How do you prove someone is a control person?
The court made it clear that you have to show these so-called control persons had actual control over how the corporation was running. Now, that doesn't automatically mean they had to be the ones signing off on every misleading statement or shady deal. It's a bigger picture thing. It's about their overall influence and power over the company's actions.
So it's more than just having a fancy title. It's about real demonstrable influence.
Right. Just having CEO or CFO next to your name isn't enough. There needs to be more. In Stern, the court said, okay, for now, let's assume that these executives, because of their management roles, had enough authority to potentially be considered control persons. So they let those claims move forward past that initial motion to dismiss.
So the court was basically saying, let's see if they can prove they weren't actually in control.
Pretty much. They left the door open for more investigation. And a big point the court made here was that it's not just about being involved in a specific shady transaction. It's about having your hands on the controls of the whole operation. They said, and this is a quote, active participation in operations, not just the transaction, matters. So it's that ability to really steer the ship, not just being a passenger.
That's a crucial point. It really highlights the scope of control person liability.
Now, let's circle back to those aiding and abetting claims that were dismissed. We talked about the lack of specificity, but what was the actual legal test the court applied? What does a plaintiff have to demonstrate to win an aiding and abetting case in securities fraud?
All right, so this is where the two-part test comes in. For aiding and abetting liability to stick, you need to show two things. First, the person you're accusing of aiding and abetting, they had to know about the main fraud that was going on. Or, remember that Sinder thing we talked about? They had to act with reckless disregard for the truth, like they were willfully blind to what was happening. So they couldn't just be clueless bystanders. They had to have some level of awareness, even if it was just reckless indifference.
Right. They had to be in on it in some way. The second thing you have to show is that they actually helped make that fraud happen, that they provided substantial assistance. This can be like actively participating in the scheme, you know, spreading lies, cooking the books, that kind of thing. But it can also be failing to disclose the fraud when they had a duty to do so, like if they were an auditor or something. It's about their actions, or sometimes inactions, enabling that main fraud to happen.
Okay, so two key elements, knowledge or reckless disregard and substantial assistance. And in Stern, the court found that both of these elements were lacking in the aiding and abetting claims.
Yeah, they weren't buying it. On the first part, the court said, look, your complaint doesn't really show us that these other defendants actually knew about the fraud or that they were being reckless by ignoring obvious red flags. Basically, they weren't convinced that these secondary players were truly in the know.
So insufficient evidence of awareness, or at least reckless disregard of the primary fraud. And what about the second element, the substantial assistance part?
That one the court really hammered on. They said Stern's complaint didn't lay out how these other defendants actually helped pull off the fraud. It was too vague. There weren't enough details to connect their actions or their lack of action to the main fraudulent scheme. They were like, show us the receipts. Show us how they actually contributed.
So the allegations were too general. They lacked that crucial connection between what these individuals did or didn't do and the primary fraud.
Precisely. It's like saying someone's an accomplice to a robbery, but not saying how they helped. Did they drive the getaway car? Did they provide the blueprints to the bank? You got to give the court more to work with.
Makes perfect sense. Now let's turn our attention to the FDIC, which was also named as a defendant in this case. They were involved in a slightly different capacity as the receiver for the failed American City Bank. What was the specific claim or issue that entangled the FDIC in this whole legal mess?
Okay, so remember how Stern bought those securities with a promissory note?
Right. He basically promised to pay a certain amount for those securities.
That's it. Well, as part of his whole lawsuit, he wanted that note declared null and void. He wanted to be off the hook for that debt. And he said the FDIC, because they were now the receiver for the failed bank, needed to be part of that particular claim.
So he was basically saying the bank failed and now the FDIC as receiver shouldn't be able to hold me to this promissory note.
That's the gist of it. He saw them as a necessary party to getting that note wiped clean.
What did the court have to say about the FDIC's involvement? Did they agree that the FDIC as receiver was the correct party for that specific claim?
Well, here's where things get really interesting, procedurally speaking. The court said, hold on, you're suing the wrong FDIC. They were really particular about this. They said when it comes to whether or not that note is valid, the proper party to sue is the FDIC in their corporate capacity, not as the receiver for the failed bank.
Ah, so there's a difference between the FDIC acting as receiver, stepping into the shoes of the failed bank, and the FDIC acting in its own corporate capacity.
Exactly. It's kind of like the FDIC wears two different hats, and you have to figure out which hat they're wearing for the specific legal argument you're making.
So could you break that down a bit more? What's the difference between those two roles, and why is it so important in this case?
Sure. So when the FDIC steps in as a receiver, think of it like they're becoming the cleanup crew for a failed bank. They're there to handle the bank's assets and debts, make sure depositors get their money back, and basically wind things down in an orderly way.
Makes sense. It's all about managing the fallout from the bank's failure.
Exactly. But then there's the FDIC and its corporate role. That's where they're doing things like ensuring deposits across the whole banking system, making sure there's stability, and sometimes they'll even buy up assets from failed banks, but using them on corporate funds to help with that whole resolution process. It's a different function altogether.
Okay, so two distinct roles. And in Stern, the court was essentially saying that promissory note that probably became an asset of the FDIC, but in their corporate capacity, not as receiver.
You got it. That's why they said if Stern wanted to go after that note, he needed to sue the FDIC wearing their corporate hat, because that's who likely held the rights to the note at that point. It's a super important detail, a real procedural nuance. You got to make sure you're suing the right entity, wearing the right hat for the specific claim you're bringing. It can make or break your case.
Fascinating. So as we wrap up this deep dive into Stern v. American Bankshares Corp., what are some of the biggest takeaways from this case, especially for law students who are going to be dealing with securities litigation in the future?
There's a lot to learn from this case. It's like a masterclass in securities fraud litigation, even all these years later. First off, Rule 9b, you got to know it inside and out. It's all about walking that tightrope between being specific enough to satisfy the court, but not overwhelming them with evidence that should come out later during discovery.
Right, striking that balance between pleading with particularity and not overpleading your case. And what about the different types of liability we discussed? What lessons should law students take away from Stern about control person liability and aiding and abetting?
Yeah, that's huge. You got to understand the difference between those two, how they work, what you need to prove for each one. Control person liability, that's a broad concept. It's about power, influence, the ability to prevent those securities law violations. Aiding and abetting, that's much more direct. It's about knowing about the fraud, helping it happen. They're different beasts.
And the court's very specific holding about the FDIC and its dual capacities. What's the takeaway there?
Oh, that one's a gem. When you're dealing with a government entity like the FDIC, especially one that can wear different legal hats, you have to be meticulous about knowing which capacity they're acting in for your specific claim. Getting that wrong can sink your case before it even sets sail. It's about procedural precision.
Absolutely. So Stern is really a treasure trove of practical and conceptual insights for anyone navigating the complex world of securities litigation.
It really is. And one final thing it highlights is that even though the case law evolves and technology changes, those core principles of procedural fairness and proving your case with specific facts, those are timeless. So for all you aspiring legal eagles out there, here's something to chew on. Think about how these pleading standards we talked about, especially Rule 9b, would apply in today's world, you know, where so much of the action is happening online in the digital space.
That's a great point. How do you demonstrate falsity when the alleged misrepresentations are happening on social media, in chat rooms, or even through algorithms?
Exactly. That's a real challenge. Yeah. How do you prove someone's state of mind when the communication is happening through all these different channels, often with layers of technology in between? That's something to think about as you go deeper into this field. It's not just about mastering the old rules. It's about applying them to this constantly evolving world. Anyway, thanks for joining us for this deep dive into Stern. I hope you found it helpful.